We're now moving on to item nine, Monitoring and Recovery Status of Endangered Species Act Listed Fish Populations. This is a briefing, also in response to a blue sheet. I've been looking forward to it, and I understand that there's been a lot of staff effort, and appreciate that.
Well, great. Good morning, Chair Thorberg, and Commission, and Director, and Deputy Director. And yes, this is a blue sheet request. Does that work?
I don't know why it looks like that on your screen.
So this is a blue sheet request, and we'll be talking about monitoring methods and also ESA, federally ESA, listed salmon and steelhead, and then we'll provide an overview of a couple of case studies. And then we'll end with a summary of status statewide, kind of a high-level summary. So again, my name is Eric Netherland. I'm the Science Division Manager and working in the FISH program. And here's an overview of what I described. And I thought we would start with at least just a brief overview of SAM recovery in Washington State, because it is unique. And then, like I said, we'll summarize some monitoring methods. And I think of this as kind of a primer of these monitoring methods. So, and Joe Anderson will be talking later about the OWA, and so it'll be helpful to have this primer now. And then we'll get into these two case studies and a summary of progress. So, as we all know, SAM recovery in Washington State is unique. So federally, NOAA is the entity, the federal agency that oversees the Federal Endangered Species Act, but we also have the Washington State Salmon Recovery Act, which was passed in 1999. And that put into place the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office, but also put into place the Salmon Recovery Funding Board, but also put into place this local process. And what I've listed here are these regional recovery boards. And so that's a map of those seven regional recovery boards. And within there, those boards are individual lead entity watersheds. And so the important thing to think about or to keep in mind with our SAM Recovery Act is that these regional recovery boards are actually the entities that developed the federal recovery plans that were then approved and adopted by NOAA. And then these organizations, working with the states and the co-manager, tribal co-managers, are the ones that actually implement the SAM recovery plan. So that's why it's unique. And in some ways, people say, you know, Washington, the Washington way, which is this bottom-up process. And then the other element is that the Department of Fish and Wildlife and our tribal co-managers play a critical role in those recovery plans, but also from, as we know, for fisheries and harvest management. But also the agencies and the tribes are the ones that collect most of, all majority of the data that goes into the ESA assessment. So the data that NOAA uses, the data that the recovery boards use, all those data are collected primarily on the backs of the state and the tribal co-managers. So here's a map, and I just repeated that regional recovery board map, and then I provided a list of all the species, all the salmon and steelhead that are ESA, that's federally endangered, on the Federal Endangered Species Act statewide. Lower Columbia, which is in the yellow there, has the most federally listed ESA, or salmon and steelhead. And then, as we heard this morning, the coast actually has the least. There is one listed ESA species, which is Lake Ozette sockeye. Otherwise, there are no listed ESA salmon or steelhead on the coast. And the listings occurred, a majority of them in the late 1990s, late 1998, 1999, but the most recent listing is for Puget Sound steelhead, and that occurred in 2007. So NOAA is the entity that's responsible for setting up the evaluation. One, they do the listing, so they set up the criteria for listing, but they also set up the criteria for periodic evaluation and delisting. And the way that the NOAA evaluates populations is using what they call a viable salmon population parameter, or this term VSP. And it's made up of these four components, which are abundance, productivity or reproduction, spatial distribution, sometimes it's called spatial structure, and diversity. So what I'm going to do now is just, at a high level, just go through. It's actually pretty helpful. It's helpful for me even to just remind myself, you know, how we monitor these parameters and then how they're kind of used. Again, it'll be at a high level, but I think I'm hoping it'll be helpful. So I'm going to start with that list. Just start from the top and work down. So we have adult abundance. These are methods. So abundance, again, what I'm thinking about here are the number of fish that come back to spawn, sometimes called escapement. And we, one of the key methods that the co-managers use are red surveys. So the salmon have reds, salmon nest in the river. We do flights to see those, and you can barely see it here, but if you just... If you look there, that's what that little light spot is, just a salmon red, and so a salmon nest. And we do those biologists do those by walking the streams or doing these aerial surveys. But we also have another common method is a weir. So a weir is just a structure that spans the entire river, and it can be a concrete structure. It could be a temporary weir that's just put up seasonally, and it basically blocks the fish. We can get a count, a census, and then there are different mechanisms for moving the fish upstream of those weirs. We also have techniques such as mark recapture, which is you actually catch the fish at a dam or a weir, tag it, and then you can, that shows a Floyd tag there, but you can then re-sight or recapture that fish later up in the watershed. So in addition to those methods that are common, we also have methods that we use whether maybe the river's too large or there's visibility issues with the water, or you just want more information. So there's kind of two general ways that we do that. One is by tagging the fish and then tracking that fish. And here I just have an example of a pit tag. It's a passive integrated transponder. Essentially, you put these are used very widely throughout the Columbia River and also are beginning to be used more and more in Western Washington. But essentially, you put a tag in a fish, you put a series of arrays out or in dams, you can tag the fish when they're very little as juveniles, so you can track them as they move through the water all the way out and then as they come back as adults. So it's very helpful for understanding movement as well as abundance. And then the other method is when we don't tag the fish. So there are methods like sonar, where you just, here's a picture of sonar, you put a sonar in the river, it takes an image, so you actually capture an image of the fish moving by, and then you can assess that to determine species and things like that. So those are very common, or at least an overview of how the agency and the co-managers look at adult abundance. But we also look at juvenile abundance. And what I mean by that is the fish that leave the system, leave the freshwater as smolts, and then they're on their way. They're leaving as smolts, and then they're entering the salt water. And here is just a photo of many different types of traps. We have traps for big rivers and traps for small rivers. So those, once you have all those abundance data, that really forms the foundation of how NOAA looks at abundance and productivity. So I thought I'd walk through this briefly. So this is just a chart of, or just a diagram, schematic of a salmon life cycle. And on the top left, you have adults coming in, or what's called fish in. And so you have that adult abundance or that spawning abundance. Once you have that abundance, you can also get information on age, and then you can actually look at productivity. And so what you're looking at is you want to have, or NOAA is looking at, having an increasing abundance or high level of abundance and stable, and they want to have productivity above one. So they want fish replacing themselves and probably more than that if their populations are very low, more than just replacing themselves. And then with the juvenile abundance, what that adds is you're actually counting the fish in, the adults, but then you can count the fish out, the juveniles, and it allows you then to look at the freshwater and the marine survival separately. So that gives you, if you count the fish in and then you can estimate the number of fish leaving the system, that provides an insight into how they're doing the freshwater versus how they're doing in the marine waters. With some additional information, you can actually look at maybe what habitat might be limiting. Is it spawning habitat that's limiting, or maybe they're more limited by rearing habitat? Similarly, you can get a measure of marine survival, but with some other research tools or some tagging, you might get an idea that, hey, these fish are not only limited just in the ocean, maybe they're limited in Puget Sound, and that's how we came to understand, or one of the ways we came to understand this, there's a problem in Puget Sound with early marine survival, was tagging fish and figuring out, was it that early phase of their life stage, not just ocean survival. So that's abundance and productivity. I'll talk briefly through the next two measures, which are spatial distribution, sometimes called spatial structure. That's just looking at where fish are spawning. So we look at abundance and where their range might be restricted within the ESU. So from NOAA's perspective, they want to have fish that are abundant, and they want to have them abundant across their ESU, not just all abundant in, for example, in northern Puget Sound, but maybe we have populations that are declining in south Puget Sound. That doesn't work for recovery. And then the final measure is diversity. There are two flavors here. We have a genetic diversity, which provides, is the fish have the genetic material to weather environmental conditions? And that's done primarily by collecting samples. And then there's another measure called life history diversity, and that just that's an idea of run timing, age structure. And I kind of think this isn't exactly right, but one way to think about it is genetic material. I mean, it underlies all of this diversity, but genetic material gives the fish an ability to sort of respond to long-term changes and adapt, but life history diversity helps them overcome short-term perturbations in the system. So that's how NOAA kind of thinks of it as well. So all of those things together allow NOAA then to look at how abundant are populations, are they replacing themselves, how are they distributed across the landscape, and do they have tools, and do the fish have the tools that they need to overcome periods of perturbations or changes in environment. So with that, I thought I would just jump right into a couple of case studies, and I'm not going to go through all the data for each of these case studies, but it'll give you a sense of where they are. So I thought I'd start with Hood Canal Summer Chum, which is a population that is actually doing pretty well, especially compared to other ESA species, and Puget Sound Chinook, which I would put on the other end of that spectrum, which are not doing very well. So with Hood Canal Summer Chum, thinking back to that map I showed earlier with the regional recovery boards, the Hood Canal Coordinating Council is the actual recovery board that's in charge of implementing recovery for Hood Canal Summer Chum, obviously with the Fish and Wildlife and the co-managers. And the boards are actually made up of elected officials and tribal council members, so the tribes are intimately involved in these boards in many cases. They were listed in 1999, and they have two populations. There's one in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, where we are now, and then Hood Canal proper. And in NOAA's listing determination, they listed several factors that were leading to the listing and leading to the decline. But what I did is I listed two of the key threats that NOAA highlighted in particular, and those were harvest, and NOAA uses the term overutilization, but it was harvest, and habitat degradation and stream flow. And so what happened is, even prior to the listing, there was an indication that Hood Canal Summer Chum, just based on their abundance were in a decline, and I'll show you that graph in here in a second. But so the co-managers and recovery groups, but all the co-managers primarily prior to listing, saw that and initiated some actions. And two of those key actions were the one there on the top, where began this hatchery supplementation program and a reintroduction program that was staggered across the individual subpopulations, but they wanted to get fish back on the ground using a hatchery program. And then they reduced harvest, so eliminated direct fisheries on summer chum, but also significantly curtailed incidental harvest from other fisheries on summer chum. And they use this term base conservation regime to identify this lowered harvest. And then post-listing, with the Salmon Recovery Funding Board in place, they were able to secure federal dollars and started to implement freshwater and estuarine habitat restoration. And so here's just a graph of the abundance. And so this is adult abundance. And what you're looking at on the top slide is the Juan de Fuca population that I showed on that map earlier. And then the other on the bottom part of the graph is that Hood Canal population. And the it might be hard to see, but if you look there, it goes back to 1974, and you can see there was a slow decline from 1974 to the early 1990s, and that vertical red line is when the fish were actually ESA listed in 1999, and then you start to see a slow increase, and the yellow on the bar charts are actually that portion of the population that represents those reintroduced fish from a hatchery population. So you can see the wild population start to rebound, and the thought is from just a reduction in the fisheries, but there's also this supplemented part of the population represented by those yellow bars. So both of those things combined, we're working together to begin to rebuild the population. Those two horizontal lines are just the low threshold for recovery, so a low recovery target for abundance and a higher recovery target for abundance. So ideally you want to have, at the very minimum at the low end of that bar, but you want it above the higher one would be an indication that you're really approaching recovery. So This is a very good indication that they're on their way to recovery. I'm not going to go through all the data on productivity and spatial structure and diversity, but they are making progress in those areas. I think productivity overall is not where people want it to be, where NOAA wants it to be, but still making progress. So I would say that it is safe to say that that the consensus on Hood Canal Summer Chum is that they are on their road to recovery. Not to say that they're there by any stretch, but they are a species that we can start to think about ESA delisting. And in fact, the Regional Recovery Organization, NOAA, SAM Recovery Funding Board are all having conversations about what can we do to get this species across the line for ESA delisting. And so we started those conversations. We want to continue with some actions. There are actions that the Recovery Board has thought about in the quill scene and the duckabush, and big habitat actions that they want to move forward with. And then the one question hanging out there is, how resilient is this recovery going to be to changing climate and stream flows, but also ocean conditions? We're coming into a period of poor ocean conditions, and so that's going to be that's going to be a test here. Can this population maintain its abundance through this next period of poor ocean conditions? If it does, I think we have a very good case for delisting Summer Chum, or taking our case to NOAA, I should say. So, with Puget Sound Chinook, I would say I'd put this population at the other end of the spectrum. They are actually, the Regional Recovery Organization is Puget Sound Partnership. Initially, it was what was called the Shared Strategy, but that's been changed when the Puget Sound Partnership was put into place. They were listed in 1998, and unlike having two populations with Hood Canal Summer Chum, we have 22 individual populations in Puget Sound. And then I'm not going to read all of those listing factors, but you can see they're focused on habitat, toxics and contaminants, some harvest issues, disease or predation, etc. A whole host of issues that NOAA listed in their listing determination. So I'm going to just show two graphs of abundance here. I just summarized all the abundance so you can kind of get a sense, but then I'll look at them independently. But you can see, stretching back to 1970 for wild Chinook, it's been kind of a slow decline. And then when they were listed with that vertical line, you can see that maybe there was a slight bump, but maybe just a variation, I would say, in the long-term decline, and then a continued decline. So really, no, we have not seen any turnaround for Chinook, I would say, overall, at least at the ESU scale. If you dig in a little bit, it's helpful to look at this graph. It's a little complicated, I realize, but essentially all it's telling us is there are all these populations across the bottom. So there are 22 populations that go across the bottom. And then to make it actually semi-legible, we looked at just immediately post-listing, so that the dark bar is 1999 when they were listed. So and this graph is actually pulled from Puget Sound Partnership, a report using DFW data. But in there's the dark red red bar is an average, a four-year average immediately post-listing, and then we just compared that with a four-year average, the most recent four-year average. And again, all we're trying to get there, we know there's this long-term decline, but what's happening to these individual populations? So what you can see pretty clearly in those bars right here are just, that's the high recovery target and the lowest recovery target. And, you know, it's pretty clear that all these populations are very, very, they're all below their lowest population level. You can barely see some of these populations. With the exception of when you get into northern Puget Sound and you look at maybe Upper Skagit, where you can see that there isn't an increase necessarily on the average since 1999 compared to 2012 and 2016, but there's still, you know, quite a few fish. And so, you know, this is just an indication that Puget Sound, I mean, that Chinook and Puget Sound are doing poorly. Although we do have this area in northern Puget Sound where they're still holding on. I would say the same thing for Steelhead as well. There's this area in northern Puget Sound that is an anchor for these populations. So when NOAA looked at this in their latest five-year status review, they identified some areas of progress, and then they identified areas of continued challenges. So for progress, we have areas of the harvest and hatcheries were identified where there's been significant progress in both of those H's. They also identified regulatory mechanisms as being, there's being moderate progress, so and they were in particular looking at some things like Shoreline Master Program, and thought that there was actually some progress, not that there, but there still needs to be some. But the areas where they particularly were concerned with were freshwater habitat, nearshore and estuary habitat. And then what I've added here is kind of added just a little bit of information for you, which is we know from research that what's emerging as a picture for Chinook is this part in their life phase, in their life stage, this rearing habitat, and as they move into the estuary as small fish, that estuarine habitat in Puget Sound right now is emerging as a critical bottleneck for Puget Sound. I mean, the science is coming forward from many places. It says, you know, you can keep putting fish back on the spawning grounds, which we need to do. We need to continue to improve spawning habitat. But until we fix this problem of this rearing habitat in the freshwater and this rearing habitat in these pocket estuaries and estuaries, we're not going to see the recovery that we need. So that's helpful from a recovery perspective for us to have that kind of focus. I don't want to send the message that's all that is wrong, but that's an area that needs attention. We also know that Puget Sound health and early marine survival is an issue both for Steelhead and for Chinook for different reasons. But again, for Chinook, it's probably related to that the forage and having habitat for safety and for forage. And then we also know with Chinook, they're facing a changing climate, but also ocean conditions we're going into a poor ocean condition phase, and so that's going to continue to be a major challenge for Chinook.
Commissioner Kehoe has a question.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
So on the progress that NOAA has documented with respect to hatcheries, can you elaborate a little bit on that? What does that mean?
Well, that means that the department and others have taken actions in the hatcheries that are considering the effects on ESA. And so there have been reductions in production and they're also having our programs that are in line with ESA and permit and going after and achieving hatchery genetic management plans and making sure that those programs are operated in a way that is in line with the goals of ESA. And so after their review, what they looked at and they said, those are areas where we've made progress, and they compared that with areas like the habitat where we're continuing to see this decline in habitat. And so I think that's the way to think about it. Are we all the way there? No, we're still implementing hatchery reform, but the fact that we've implemented our marked selective fisheries, that we're looking at hatcheries and evaluating both the genetic effects and some of the ecological effects. They were content that we were on a path that we were on a pathway to success, or at least on a pathway forward with those, where they didn't, when the status review didn't feel the same, that there was that same level of progress in the habitat arena.
Just to follow up on that, harvest, it's the same thing, that it's selective fisheries now and more regulated?
Yes, and there's been a lot of progress with the, with especially marked selective fisheries, and also just, our international fisheries agreements and reducing harvest, both in our mixed stock fisheries out in the ocean as well as in our marine waters and terminal areas. So. So I'm going to step back to a statewide perspective. So I only have two more slides, so then I'm finished. But if you think back to that list of species of ESA listed species, this is just looking at those same ESA listed species. But I extracted this chart from the Governor Sam Recovery Office State of Sam report. And the way to read this is you look at the two left columns, and those are populations that are not doing well or continuing to decline. And as an example, you see Puget Sound Chinooks, Puget Sound Steelhead, and Upper Columbia Spring Chinook. You know, they're either continuing to decline or their population abundances are so low they really can't go any lower and they're not coming back. You move one column over, maybe we've stemmed the decline, but they're still not making progress. And if you compare that with the two columns on the right, you have this column here where we're still well below the recovery goal, but they're starting to make progress. So they're actually there's a positive trajectory there, but in no way are they near recovery. Then you have these two populations over here, which are Hood Canal Summer Chum and Snake River Falls Chinook, and those are populations that are potentially approaching their goals. So one thing, I would say this is not a statistical analysis. This is based on, where the kind of trends and GSRO put this in a framework like this to help us kind of get our head around, the relative status of species. But the one thing to think about here is that when all these species were listed, they were probably all very much on the left side of this graph. So while I think in many cases challenges for ESA are outstripping progress, I think this is an indication that in some areas we are making progress. So with that, I will step back even further and kind of not summarize what I just talked about. I was just going to provide some closing remarks. So I just wanted to share some high-level messages around SAM recovery that I think are important, or at least resonate with me. First, Washington is viewed as a model of success for SAM recovery. We hear this time and time again. When we reach out to our local recovery boards, we hear from our local elected officials that going into this in 1999, they wanted nothing to do with SAM recovery, and they wanted to basically kill it. But we hear time and time again that we have local county commissioners that travel back to Washington, D.C. to support salmon funding for salmon recovery. And I think that's a powerful message. And we hear that from other states, and we hear that from our congressional delegation. Second, related to that, we really need to stay the course. We've taken two decades as a state and have invested in this infrastructure of people, of relationships, and it's beginning to pay off. We're beginning to have hard conversations in areas like the Skagit, which it would never be possible to have those conversations without those relationships and that long-term investment in human capital and relationships. So I think the message that I hear and that I would emphasize for all of you is that we need to stay the course with our federal funding and keeping pressure on our federal partners to keep funding coming back to the Washington state so we can make some progress on ESA. And I think the third bullet there, I think to actually make that message resonate, we need to sort of have some success. And I think we have populations that we could potentially hold up as a success. And so I think it could help us give us all a laser sharp focus in some areas to get there. And then finally, just kind of hearkening back to 1999 with the Locke administration, who said extinction is not an option. And I would sort of modify that and say, it's not only an option, we really need to get the recovery. We know salmon are critical to our economies. Well, we cannot have, we know that we can't implement fisheries without recovery, because fisheries and hatcheries are so intricately linked to wild fish recovery. And so for us, it's not only extinction is not an option, I feel that we really have to get the recovery to also maintain our fisheries. So with that, I would end the presentation, and I would be happy to take questions.
Commissioners? Thank you. Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about Chum, and then I have a question about Elwha Chinook.
Okay.
Giraffe, so, which you might hear a little bit more about later today. On slide number 15, where you show the Hood Canal and the Wanda Fuca populations of summer Chum, and the Strait of Juan de Fuca populations is kind of a wow. I mean, it's a very strong showing there of how something was headed down, and now things are much, much better. So that's obviously a very strong success story. Earlier, you may have heard me ask a question of the wildlife side of, is there a goal that when it's a goal as a criteria, that when it's attained, then things are delisted. So you've got a couple of red lines here that you referred to, and it's good to see on the bottom graph that there's only a couple of years that are below the lowest of the red lines. But when you talked about delisting, you said there's spatial things and there's general diversity things and number of populations and et cetera, et cetera. So my question is there a definition and a criteria upon which there would be a delisting decision that would be triggered or brought before us? You mentioned working with them to think about what would it would take to have these not be listed, which made me think there is not a set of criteria. You talked about Snake River Falls Chinook being near their goal, and that's another substantial success story up there, and the tribal folks up there deserve a lot of credit for what they've done. But I think I recall the delisting criteria being talked about at one point in time was a rolling average of 5 or 7 years above a particular number that's probably been exceeded several fold in recent years. So again, my question is, for these things that are nearing their goal, what is the goal? What is the delisting criteria?
They do have goals, and I was looking, I was almost certain, I put it in my notes here, but I'd have to go back to my notes, but on the lower threshold, what I recall for the San Juan de Fuca population is it's 4,500 and it might be 4,500 and 5,200 are the upper and lower bounds, and then on the Hood Canal population it was, I think, 17,400 and 22,000 and some number. So there are specific recovery goals for abundance. My recollection is there 1.2 is the goal for productivity. And then with spatial structure, I didn't show that, but they have the Hood Canal Coordinating Council has a map of subpopulations. So within Hood Canal, they have populations that they've identified that need to meet these targets. And some of those populations, like in eastern Hood Canal, have been extirpated and they're extinct, but they're not required for recovery. So there are goals, and that is the discussion with that we would have with the federal agencies are, okay, what language would need to be in the next 5-year status review that would then set up the possibility of trying to delist in the following 5-year status review? So there are specific targets and goals laid out in the recovery plans.
So as a follow-up on the Snake River Falls Chinook, is there then a number that's a five-year average?
There is, and the one complicating thing in this, in the fall Snake River Falls Chinook is, you know, there's a large portion of the returning fish are hatchery fish, right? And so, and some of those are marked, and some of those aren't. But there is a goal for recovery for the Falls Chinook as well. I don't have that number off the top of my head. I'd have to get that for you.
But there's not an automatic trigger?
There's no automatic trigger, at least to my knowledge, that once you hit it, what it is just, it's a recovery goal that then allows the NOAA, during their, they do a five-year status review, and that that is the process that NOAA uses to delist. And it's the process they use to the five-year status review. They can recommend a population or ESA species for delisting, but they can also recommend changes like, oh, we want to change the population structure. So instead of 22 populations, we want Puget Sound Chinook to have 20 populations. So they can make those sorts of changes as well as delisting. But it's not a specific threshold that once you hit this, the population is delisted.
Yes.
Thank you. And then my question on Elwha Chinook, which is on your slide number 19. We're going to get to see a little and hear a little bit more about that later today. But the bars above the Elwha there, could you say again what those are for?
Yeah, so that
came about.
Yeah, the... This, each of those bars, for each individual population, the NOAA has set an individual recovery goal. And so those, but in Puget Sound, they have set kind of a low threshold recovery goal and an upper threshold recovery goal. And that is based on some of their modeling and then looking at measures of productivity. So if there was a measure of low productivity over an extended period of time, they said this would be the lowest, you know, this would be the lowest target and this would be an upper threshold. So it's kind of like for Puget Sound, they provided a range of recovery that gives them more flexibility in sort of evaluating their status as they for delisting, essentially.
You didn't explain the stars on that graph.
Oh, yeah, thank you. So the stars are just those populations that have showed a significant, maybe a significant increase in that time period, or the dark green star, there hasn't really been a significant increase, but that just showed for the upper Skagit that they're actually, those populations are above that threshold. So it was just a way to focus your attention on, you know, again, with the Swaddle population, their recovery goal is low, but there has been a significant increase, even though it's still low abundance there.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one more follow-up on the Elwha.
So yes.
There is not a historical abundance pattern, obviously, on the Elwha. So those are habitat capacity type goals?
Those based on habitat capacity, right.
Thank you. Other questions, commissioners? I'd like to go back to slide 15, the Hood Canal Summer Chum. And what I'm interested in is it appears that there is now, at least in the last few years, very little hatchery stock. So has that addition, supplementation stopped?
Yeah, the way they rolled through that is they had each of the reintroduction programs for each of the they reintroduced the summer chum were to do it by kind of subpopulation, so in individual rivers essentially, and they had a kind of a 12-year reintroduction period, but they staggered that so not all the rivers started reintroduction at the same time. And then what they did is they thermally marked those fish, and Amy mentioned that earlier today. So they put a thermal mark on the fish bone, the ear bone, so they could that way they're not externally marked. and then they could detect, they would read those thermal marks when they returned. And what you're seeing there is that they ramped up this reintroduction program, got a lot in what they call is a kind of a trying to give the population a demographic boost. And so they've given that population a demographic boost, and now they're in this evaluation phase where they're ramping down the reintroduction, and then it'll just be fish returning that will spawn in the gravel.
Just to follow up on that, those hatchery fish that were introduced, were they produced according to current genetic management standards? So the eggs were taken from natural origin fish? And
I can get back to you with the details on that, but in general what happened was there were some places where the populations were completely extinct, so they had to pull those populations from other areas. There were genetic analyses conducted to make sure that they were, you know, that they met, if they knew that they closely matched their natal stream, but in some cases they weren't able to pull fish from that natal stream because it was a complete reintroduction.
Great. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Eric. That was just exactly the high level that we needed, I think.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I needed.